Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
It's 4 p.m. in London, 11 a.m. in Washington, Miami and New York, and 7 p.m. in Moscow. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. I'm Jack Foster. Carolyn Scott is not with us today or tomorrow. In fact, she's back on Monday. Coming up on today's programme, Britain's ambassador to the EU has privately told the government that a post-Brexit trade deal with the European Union could take up to 10 years to finalise. That's the consensus amongst European politicians, according to Sir Ivan Rogers. We get reaction this hour from Conservative MP and former Cabinet Minister Peter Lilly. A report by the International Crisis Group has exposed that the militants in Myanmar involved in killing 9 border guards back in October could have links that are being commanded by people in Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. We ask what the connection is. Venezuela's Foreign Minister Delcy Rodriguez is making waves in Buenos Aires this week after her country was ousted from the Mercosur trading bloc last week. She's been turned away after trying to crash the members' meeting in Argentina. But is this a genuine attempt at re-entry to Mercosur or a bit of political theatre? Russian President Vladimir Putin is to meet with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe in the Japanese mountainside town of Niigata to discuss an ongoing territorial dispute between the two countries. The dispute over the Northern Territories, as they're referred to in Japan, has strained relations between the two countries since World War II, and a détente would seriously improve Russia's standing in the Asia-Pacific region. The final search for missing Malaysian flight MH370 has started, with investigators saying the search will be wound down for good in January if no sign of the missing plane is found. But for relatives, the pain will go on. And how would you imagine that a bunch of British politicians covering a Christmas song might turn out? We never know. It could even be worse than you're imagining. All that and more over the next hour on this Thursday edition of World in Focus. A post-Brexit trade deal between Britain and the EU might take 10 years to finalise, and even then, it could still fail. That's what European politicians have told Britain's ambassador to the EU, Sir Ivan Rogers. Rogers relayed the information that a deal is not expected to be done until the mid-2020s to Prime Minister Theresa May and her cabinet in October. He also said that the deal could still be rejected by any of the 27 national European parliaments during the ratification process. But Conservative MPs have played down the news. Liam O'Hare has more.
Well, the advice given to the government by Sir Ivan Rogers contrasts sharply with suggestions that a deal could be completed within 2 years of Article 50 being triggered. It raises the prospect of damaging World Trade Organization tariffs and border checks being imposed on British businesses from the day that Britain exits the bloc. Well, earlier I spoke to Conservative MP and Brexit supporter Peter Lilly. He told me that the 10-year estimates for a trade deal have been exaggerated.
Well, this is nonsense in three dimensions. First, it would take as long to negotiate a transitional arrangement for the 10-year period as it would to negotiate a permanent arrangement. So we may as well go and negotiate a permanent arrangement straight away. Second, there are only two realistic outcomes of any negotiations with the EU. Either that we continue to negotiate with no tariffs on each other's goods and no new barriers to our services, or we move to trading on World Trade Organization terms, the same terms as we trade with the rest of the world. Both of those are incredibly simple to negotiate. To go from no tariffs to no tariffs can be done in an afternoon. It's totally different from a new type of negotiating a new trade agreement between countries which do have tariffs with each other on 5,000 different products, 5,000 different tariffs. Negotiating which come down, when and how fast is a complex process. If you start with no tariffs and you want to end up with no tariffs, it is very simple. The other alternative of going to trading on World Trade Organization terms doesn't even require an agreement. It's what happens if we simply walk away. And from the British point of view, it's less good than continuing the present terms, but it's better than the situation we had before, because we'd then be able to negotiate free trade agreements with the rest of the world where the majority of our trade goes. You know, there's too much credibility is given to these speculative stories, which have absolutely no foundation as far as any thinking person's concerned. time.
Why then, in your estimation, have these comments been made and why have they been leaked to the public?
Well, according to the government, which is quite credible, they've simply been related retailing speculation from other governments. The governments, by and large, haven't thought about this much. Individual governments have no experience of trade negotiations because it's been handled for them by the EU. They're told by their officials it's all terribly complicated. They know that the trade deal between Europe and Canada took 8 years, but that was starting where we had 5,000 different tariffs. Canada had 5,000 different tariffs, and we had to negotiate them away. In any case, wasn't the primary issue facing either Canada or Europe. So we're a totally different situation, but they're just confusing like and unlike apples and pears.
Do you think it's possible that once a trade deal has been agreed with the different European states, that they could in fact then be rejected by their own parliaments?
Yes, that is perfectly possible. It could be, although it depends on the nature of the deal. If it comes under the common commercial policy of the EU, it will be agreed on a majority basis, and so an individual country wouldn't be able to veto it. If we made it unnecessarily complicated and included investment and other matters, which are the competence of individual member states, then that would be laying it open to being vetoed by them. That's another reason for keeping it simple, straightforward, and saying to them at the beginning, do you want a deal? If so, let's have one quickly. If you don't, let's move straight to trading on World Trade Organization terms, which, as I say, are the terms we trade successfully with the rest of the world, and the rest of the world, particularly countries like China, America, Japan and Russia, trade with the EU. And they're the four most successful countries at trading with the EU, so they can't be bad terms.
Since the Brexit vote in June, there seems to have been a sense of antagonism, perhaps expectedly, between Britain and the rest of the European Union. Do you expect that to continue, or do you think there needs to be a more consensual, more conducive approach taken, indeed, by both the British government and by the European Union itself?
I don't detect a sense of antagonism. There's, of course, a negotiating posturing which goes on, even in friendly deals. I shouldn't put too much weight on that. To some extent, the Europeans would like us to get on with it. I'd like us to get on with it. We ought to have a mutual interest in ending uncertainty, and therefore we ought to be, both sides ought to want to reach an agreement as speedily as possible, preferably in less than 2 years.
And when then do you expect to see Article 50 triggered? I know you want to see it triggered sooner rather than later, but do you think we could go some time into 2017 before it is in fact triggered?
Well, the Prime Minister said it will be triggered by 31st of March next year. I hope it will be triggered before then, but there's no reason to suppose there'll be any delays beyond that. I can't see the Supreme Court ruling, even if it upholds what the High Court said, altering that date, because the House of Commons has already overwhelmingly voted calling on the government to trigger Article 50 before the 31st of March.
Peter Lilley, Conservative MP, thanks so much for your time and joining us today on World in Focus.
Pleasure. Thank you.
In October, a group of militants from Myanmar's Rohingya Muslim minority killed 9 border guards in an attack that shook the country. It's now been revealed by the International Crisis Group that the men were commanded by people with links to Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, and possibly affiliates to Al-Qaeda in the Indian subcontinent. Matthew Waiton has more.
A group from Myanmar's persecuted Rohingya Muslims that carried out an attack on Myanmar border guards back in October is being commanded by people with links to Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, claims a new report by the International Crisis Group. The attacks on October the 9th killed 9 policemen and caused a widespread crackdown by the security forces in the Muslim-majority north. The predominantly Buddhist government in Myanmar, led by Nobel Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi, blames the Rohingyas for supporting the militants that carried out the attacks, calling them terrorists. Well, joining me now to discuss this in further detail is the author of the report for the International Crisis Group, Tim Johnston. Tim, thank you for agreeing to talk to us here on Sputnik Radio. So could you just clear up for some of our listeners who might be a bit unsure, who are the Rohingya people and can you tell us a little bit about their plight, please?
The Rohingya are a Muslim minority that live in Rakhine State in Myanmar, Western Burma, on the border with Bangladesh. And they are Bengali-speaking, and the most majority Buddhist population of Myanmar regard them, many of them anyway, regard the Rohingya as illegal immigrants, for want of a better word. They have been historically very badly discriminated against, and that has accelerated. There were very nasty ethnic riots in 2012, And there are still, we're not entirely sure how many, but more than 100,000 Rohingya in miserable camps in various parts of Rakhine. And some of your listeners, I'm sure, will have known that thousands of Rohingya took to boats in 2013, 2014, trying to escape. And since then, the situation has got worse. They're desperately short of food, many of them. They are systematically discriminated against. You have to get a license to get married. You have to get a license to go to the next village. You have to get a license to get a job. You know, this is, under some measures, the most discriminated against minority in the world, and anger has been growing. And with the closure of the sort of maritime escape route over the last couple of years, a lot of people have just lost hope, and that's curdled into anger, essentially.
And of course, the leader of Myanmar, Aung San Suu Kyi, is a Nobel Peace Prize winner. But what is she doing to lessen the suffering of the Rohingya Muslims?
She's in a difficult position. I mean, she is a Nobel Peace Prize winner, as you say. She's also the leader of a very chauvinist Buddhist country. The Myanmar people don't agree on much, but the one thing they do tend to agree on is that they don't like Muslims. And, you know, it's particularly acute in Rakhine, but I was up in Kaffa, where George Orwell famously was based, which is probably 1,000 kilometres from Rakhine. And we were getting mosques burnt there as well. You know, this is a very difficult political problem. Suu Kyi has massive support in Myanmar, but she can't just say, you know, we like these guys. It's like a popular British prime minister saying, we like immigrants, we're going to open the gates and let anyone who wants to come in, come in. You know, with the best will in the world, that would be deeply unpopular. So her room for manoeuvre is very limited. There are people, credible people, who say that she's actually not doing what she could do, even within those limits. But, you know, it's a very difficult problem. And waving, not even Suu Kyi, a woman who has massive support, can wave a wand and make this go away.
Focusing more now on the recent report by the crisis group, the Rohingya group that calls itself the Haraka al-Yakin carried out attacks on the Myanmar border guards back in October, and it claimed responsibility for those attacks. Can you tell us a bit about the connection between these militants to places like Saudi Arabia and Pakistan?
We've talked to a number of the people who were involved in these attacks, and we believe that their leadership are Rohingya, but they are based mostly in Saudi Arabia, in Mecca, and in one instance in Medina. And there are the attack on October the 9th, 9 policemen killed, 62 weapons seized, 10,000 rounds of ammunition. It was tactically kind of sophisticated. They attacked 3 different posts simultaneously. They mined the roads so reinforcements couldn't come in. You know, it wasn't hugely sophisticated. A lot of them were carrying knives rather than guns because they didn't have them, we believe. But it was more sophisticated than you would expect from an indigenous group. So we think that there is definite funding coming from other parts of the world, Middle East. We think there is training and tactical expertise. You know, there's an IED, improvised explosive device there. What we don't think yet, and that's a very important caveat, we don't think yet that this is a sort of transnational jihadi group like ISIS or Al-Qaeda. This is an ethno-nationalist group. They are fighting for a better deal for the Rohingya. They, you know, what we're basing this on is the videos that they've released, but also the fact that as far as we can determine, they haven't actually attacked any of the Buddhist population in Rakhine. They've gone for the border guard posts, they've shot a lieutenant colonel, you know, they've hit the army, they've hit the border police, but they've not yet turned on Buddhists.
This sort of ties in with what I wanted to ask you next. The report highlights that groups like the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda have referred to the plight of the Rohingya people, and that the battlefield experience of some of the Rohingya fighters suggests possible training and links to international militants. But are there any signs that some of the Rohingya have adopted the discourse of jihad?
Well, yes and no. No, we don't have any solid evidence of that yet. However, you know, if you can radicalise a guy in East Kilbride and you can radicalise a guy in Brussels, you can probably radicalise a Rohingya. And a lot of them are migrants. They're in the Middle East. But what we haven't seen so far is widespread adoption of the IS theories, the IS total war, ultra-violence sort of ideas. However, you know, we know that IS is under pressure. We know that they are looking to other conflicts to sort of infect southern Philippines, perhaps southern Thailand, Indonesia, and the Rohingya. And one thing we do know about organizations like IS is that they're really good at reinvention. They're really good at latching on to local discontent and giving it a sort of intellectual framework that makes burning pilots or beheading journalists seem like a reasonable response. So we haven't seen that yet, but if this pressure is kept on, we're worried that that is what will happen.
I'm glad that you said that, because I did want to ask you, considering Daesh's recent territorial losses, do you think there's a chance that perhaps the Rohingya people could become a hotbed for this type of activity?
Well, I think that they're among a number of populations that are vulnerable. I mean, if IS implodes, you are going to get IS cadres, fighters, mujahideen, whatever you want to call them, going home or finding other causes to fight for. You will have some of the money that is funding IS looking for other outlets. And there are a number of obvious places to go, the southern Philippines, the Rohingya. You know, there will be people trying to turn this conflict into a global cause of the type that we have seen with Boko Haram in Nigeria, northern Mali. You know, there are plenty, Yemen. There are plenty of other conflicts that they have managed to infect. And we're very worried that this will become one of them. Although we do think, you know, it is so far, as I said, an ethno-nationalist conflict rather than a global jihadi conflict. And we think there will be some intellectual resistance to IS, but whether that will be enough to this organization, which we know is A, ruthless, and B, very good at reinventing itself, I don't know.
Okay, Tim Johnston from the International Crisis Group. Very interesting. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Matt.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Welcome back. Still to come on today's Carolyn Scott Free Thursday programme, Venezuela's Foreign Minister Delcy Rodriguez is making waves in Buenos Aires this week after her country was ousted from Mercosur's trading bloc last week. Well, she's been turned away after trying to crash the members' meeting in Argentina. Is this a genuine attempt at re-entry to Mercosur or a bit of political theatre? The Russian President Vladimir Putin is to meet with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe in the Japanese mountainside town of Niigata to discuss an ongoing territorial dispute between the two countries. The dispute over the Northern Territories, as they're referred to in Japan, has strained relations between the two countries since World War II, and a detente would seriously improve Russia's standing in the Asia-Pacific region. And how would you imagine British politicians singing a Christmas song, not even for charity, might turn out? Well, you never know. It could even be worse than you're imagining. As we reported last Tuesday, after months of escalating threats, Venezuela was finally expelled from the self-styled common market of the South on Friday. That suspension being justified on the basis that the country had violated the bloc's democratic principles. It comes at an awkward time for Venezuela, of course, as it was actually due to take over the Mercosur presidency. However, there have been concerns over a growing discord in the country amid a political standoff between Maduro and the opposition-dominated parliament against a backdrop of an economic crisis which has come to define life in Venezuela in recent years. Now, Venezuelan Foreign Minister Delcy Rodriguez, however, was defiant from the get-go. She said last week on Twitter that Venezuela did not recognise the decision to suspend the country. And she took that defiance to new levels yesterday when she arrived in Buenos Aires in what's been described by some as akin to a Caribbean soap opera, with the intention of crashing the Mercosur Council meeting. This followed on from reports that Ms. Rodriguez's Argentinian counterpart, Susana Malcora, had allegedly officially requested that she not attend the Mercosur members' meeting. Delcy Rodriguez has since stated that, quote, "If they insist on not allowing me in, we will do so through a window, because we're here to defend the rights of Venezuela." Hugo Perez Arnaiz is Associate Professor of Sociology at the Central University of Venezuela, and he joins me on the line now from Bilbao. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us today, Mr. Arnaiz. Might we look at this as now being more perhaps about publicity and maybe an element of theatre on the part of Delcy Rodriguez than a genuine attempt to influence the will of Mercosur?
I think so, most definitely. I think Delcy Rodríguez is now, the information are correct, she's now in Uruguay meeting the Uruguay's foreign minister. Uruguay is the country that was closest to the Venezuelan position, although lately they have said that they back whatever decision the Mercosur bloc is going to take. So I think Delcy Rodríguez is pretty much aware that she was not going to do much by going to Argentina. It was more of a, yes, of a publicity stunt. And I think so that... I think it was more for the internal consumption of Venezuelans than a real diplomatic move, if you will, because she must have known that she was not going to be let into the meeting. It was very clear. The Mercosur had made very clear that she was not invited, and she went anyway. So, you know, it's hard to guess what she expected to gain from this, except a propaganda coup.
And as you say, that may be aimed internally inside Venezuela. Obviously, the administration she's a part of is not particularly popular at the moment in Caracas. Is it possible that this kind of an offensive from her with regards to Mercosur may actually help the Maduro administration by getting a little bit of solidarity?
I don't really think so. It's all part of the government's attempt to stage a situation in which external agents and an external conspiracy is really causing all the troubles in Venezuela. And this is just a small little part of that rhetoric. And it does build into that rhetoric in the sense that if you read the Venezuelan state's media, they have consistently been accusing Mercosur, particularly the governments of Brazil, Paraguay, and Argentina, of being a triple alliance, a reactionary triple alliance that is, well, willing to stage a coup against the Venezuelan government and that's supporting the local opposition and so forth. And this is pretty much a small part of all that rhetoric, and Delcy Rodríguez's latest move is also part of that rhetoric. But to be honest, I don't think it's going to make much of a difference on what is happening in Venezuela right now. The internal problem in Venezuela is really, quite frankly, economic, and people are not paying much attention to these kind of international political issues.
Obviously, as you say, the Venezuelan government are keen to paint external factors as being responsible for many of the woes in Venezuela at the moment. But it would also be true to say that there is a hostility from a number of neighbouring countries that are certainly further towards the right economically than Venezuela.
Yes, yes.
And with that, I mean, what do you think the end game of this is, if you look at specifically the Mercosur situation, but also generally about hostility towards Venezuela? Is it about removing Venezuela altogether from Mercosur? And perhaps more crucially, is it to do with Venezuela's economic situation or rather its economic model?
Definitely Venezuela. Well, it was suspended from Mercosur earlier this month, and I don't see that after what Delcy Rodríguez did, Venezuela will go back in. And you are right, there is a general hostility right now among, well, the main Mercosur governments, Paraguay, Argentina, and Brazil. And that has to do also, if we take a step back, you have to remember that Mercosur is in the middle right now of negotiations with the European Union and with China, a very complex negotiation, free trade agreements negotiations. And most certainly, these governments do not want Venezuela in the middle of those negotiations. Remember that Mercosur it was founded as a free trade bloc. This is something that, you know, it doesn't correspond well with Venezuela's idea of a South American Union. So in the middle of these negotiations, the Mercosur governments did not want Venezuela to be the pro tempore president of Mercosur. It corresponded to Venezuela, that presidency, for 6 months. But they decided that they didn't want this because they are in the middle of very complex negotiations. And Mercosur is in the middle of a crisis in itself because it hasn't really been the free trade bloc promised to be, and it's finally starting to get into very serious negotiations, and well, now they have the Venezuelan problem, and most definitely they don't want this, and I think that's the background to this issue.
Just on your point there about the fact that obviously Mercosur is a free trading bloc and Venezuela, that isn't particularly compatible with that, you could be forgiven for asking what on earth was Venezuela doing in Mercosur in the first place, and why on earth would it be particularly bothered about whether or not it's allowed to be in it now?
That's the same question that Paraguay asked when Venezuela started negotiations to become a member of Mercosur. There could be many ideas about that. One of the things is that Venezuela at that time, or when it was in the middle of negotiation, was still riding the wave of higher oil prices, so it had deep pockets, and it was trying to influence the whole architecture of regional organizations from, you know, UNASUR, the OAS, the Organization of American States, the Andean Parliament, Mercosur, and it was just in a general offensive in all these organizations, and it wanted to be part of Mercosur, and it wanted to sway Mercosur to a different type of South American union. At that time, of course, Argentina, Brazil were also, well, the governments of Argentina and Brazil were more friendly to Venezuela and to the more political motives behind Venezuela's attempt to get into Mercosur. Paraguay not, but Paraguay had been suspended in 2012 because of a coup, so that cleared the way for Venezuela to get into Mercosur. But, you know, now the situation, the tide has turned. Brazil and Argentina now have governments more to the right, and they're not friendly anymore with the Venezuelan position.
And, of course, Venezuela doesn't have the deep pockets it once did.
Doesn't have the deep pockets to influence diplomacy, to back its diplomacy.
Hugo Perez Hernes, thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you.
Former French Prime Minister Manuel Valls, who is running for president, has promised, if elected, to change the constitution and abolish the article which allows bills to pass through the parliament without debates or voting. Well, that's according to an announcement that he made today. Article 49.3 of the French constitution allows the Prime Minister and his government in certain cases to adopt a bill immediately and without a vote in the parliament. The parliament can issue a vote of no confidence in the government within 24 hours after the article is used. Valls explained during his appearance on France Interradio, quote, "I know perfectly what negative consequences Article 49.3 can carry. In our society, the use of this article is archaic and seems cruel." He added that he plans to abolish this article and only use it when the bill in question considers financial issues of the state. If elected, Valls promised to start working on the reform as soon as autumn 2017. All of that said, however, Manuel Valls, who was French Prime Minister from October 2014 to December 2016, used Article 49.3 several times whilst being in office, including the labour legislation reform in early 2016. The French presidential elections are due to take place in April and May of next year. You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. Russian President Vladimir Putin is visiting Japan today to discuss signing a peace treaty over a decades-old territorial dispute. The two will hold a series of talks at a mountainside inn at a hot spring resort called Nagato in Abe's home constituency in southwest Japan. Following this, the Russian delegation and their Japanese hosts will move to the capital, Tokyo, on Friday. Speaking to the Japanese media ahead of the visit, Mr. Putin said that Moscow and Tokyo should find a solution that's acceptable to both nations. But he also expressed reservations about whether Japan would be willing to go far enough without upsetting the United States. For more on the history of the dispute, here's Matthew Aiton.
The Russian President Vladimir Putin arrived in Japan on Thursday for a meeting with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. The two leaders will discuss an ongoing territorial dispute between the two countries over a chain of islands that sit just northwest of Japan and south of the Russian Kamchatka Peninsula. The two sides hope to sign on a number of bilateral economic agreements that would include joint work in the energy sector. The islands were seized by the Soviet Union at the end of World War II, which culminated in the dislocation of approximately 17,000 Japanese residents. Prime Minister Abe has made it one of his diplomatic missions to resolve the territorial dispute with Russia. Experts have also argued that Abe wants to forge a new start with Russia in order to offset a rising China in the Asia-Pacific. Abe told reporters in Tokyo that, quote, "I want to negotiate as the representative of Japan with the keen feelings of the former residents of the islands engraved in my heart." Well, earlier on I spoke to Professor Ra Mason, a specialist on Japanese foreign policy from the University of East Anglia, and asked him what the chances of the two countries coming to a settlement over the islands are.
Well, I think you won't get an immediate settlement as such over the islands, but what you might see, what looks like they will release some kind of statement on, is this idea of a special economic zone. And in addition, possibly the free movement, particularly of elderly Japanese relatives of former inhabitants of the islands pre-World War II, because they're in their 80s, right? So they get, you know, without sounding too harsh about it, they're going to die soon. So, you know, Putin would be able to present this as a kind of humanitarian step, right, to allow free movement of families to and from the islands, from Japan, from Hokkaido. And Abe has put forward this special economic zone, which, in other words, there'd be a kind of, you know, you have these kind of industrial zones or these specially designated zones where basically a different legal framework might apply. And that would probably be set up under Russian law. So that's something which might happen. So you might see those two things come out of it, but I think it's very unlikely that you'd see any major steps towards, for example, an actual peace treaty or towards some kind of official state-level settlement on the issue as such.
Will that be Japanese movement back to all four of the islands if necessary? Or
I'm not sure exactly where the relatives are. So most of them, I think, are on the more southerly islands, the islands immediately, the two that are immediately off the near coast of Hokkaido. But I'm not sure exactly what the breakdown is of where the different relatives are. But I think that would probably be a lesser issue because, I mean, Putin has quite a hard line in terms of the sovereignty of those islands itself, or themselves, I should say. So he's not going to, or it's very unlikely that he would actually, you know, change the law for any, you know, for movement of people per se, or to somehow change it so that there wasn't a customs barrier there. I mean, Russia's position is that there is no territorial dispute, that these are islands which Russia won at the end of the Second World War through Japan's defeat, and they are legally, you know, Russian islands. They have people, I mean, they have 30,000 people living on those islands, so, and even have a small military presence. So I don't think it would be that significant in terms of where exactly the relatives go. It would be more of a kind of humanitarian measure to allow these families to visit their grave sites, you know.
Well, joining me now to discuss this in further detail is Sir Tony Brenton, a former UK ambassador to Russia. Mr. Brenton, thank you for agreeing to talk to us here on Sputnik Radio. So could you just give us a little bit of a historical context on this? How did this dispute emerge in the first place?
Well, at the end of the Second World War, the very end of the Second World War, Russia joined the war against Japan. Up until that point, they had not launched a declared war on Japan. And in literally the last days, they seized the so-called Kuril Islands, the islands to the very north of Hokkaido, from the Japanese, and declared them part of Russia. And the Japanese have never recognized that annexation, and that has therefore remained a source of dispute between them ever since, and indeed has prevented them signing a peace treaty ending the state of war between them, so that technically they're still at war, although of course they don't behave like it. And, you know, it's obstructed their relations in other ways, it's kind of limited economic cooperation, and so on.
Yes, this is what I wanted to ask you next. How problematic has the dispute been for bilateral relations between Japan and Russia?
Well, it looms over the bilateral relations, the fact that they don't have a peace treaty. As I say, the Russians have been a bit inhibited about building up trading relations with Japan, although there are quite strong trading relations. The Russians sell gas in particular to Japan. But the level of trade is much less than it likely would have been if there had been better relations on the political front.
Surely the resolution of this dispute would be advantageous for both Japan and Russia as neighbours and economic powerhouses. What have been the main impediments to achieving peace over this?
You're absolutely right. In an entirely rational world, they'd do a deal. And indeed, back in the 1950s, the Russians offered a deal under which two of the smaller islands would return to Japan, and the Japanese turned it down. And the problem is that both the populations, both the Japanese population and the Russian population, are very averse to handing over rights over these territories. And their politicians are constrained by the will of their populaces. So it's been impossible for a long, long time for either government to move. Now, that may be changing now because the world has changed. The big thing that has changed in that region is, of course, the rise of China, which has left Japan feeling quite nervous about its security situation, particularly given doubts about the American guarantee. And while the Russians actually have very good relations with China, they don't want to be utterly dependent on China in the region. So both sides have quite a strong interest in strengthening their relationship as a slight antidote to dependence on China on the part of Russia and fear of China on the part of Japan, which is why these talks have opened with much more optimism about progress on the Kuril Islands than has happened for a very long time.
Do you think that these talks could be a sign of Abe trying to warm up to Russia in anticipation of the Trump presidency? Because, of course, it looks likely that there might be a détente of some description between the American administration under Trump and the Russian government.
Well, yeah, I mean, lots and lots of people are worried about what a Trump presidency is going to be like. And the Japanese have particular reason to be worried because what Trump said during the campaign was that the Japanese should be able to defend themselves and should acquire nuclear weapons themselves rather than depending upon America. Now, I suspect that once Trump is actually in power, that will not be the line that his government takes. But even so, the Japanese are worried. They've seen America losing standing in the world in all sorts of ways, I mean, which Syria is the most recent example. And they're concerned to bolster, they will want to maintain extremely close supportive relations with America, of course, but they are looking for other stilts to their foreign policy, if I can put it that way, and an improvement to their relations with Russia would be very helpful from that point of view.
And how is the United States reacting at the moment to this meeting between Putin and Russia? There was a recent piece in the New York Times, I think it was, which said that Abe had, quote, brushed off concerns from the Obama administration.
Well, there are concerns in the United States because, of course, one of the roles that Japan is playing at the moment is as part of the coalition which imposed sanctions and notionally isolation on Russia after what happened in Ukraine and in Crimea. And it's quite interesting reading accounts of the meeting between Abe and Putin that has already taken place, that they seem to have agreed to resume security contacts, contacts between foreign ministers and defence ministries.
OK, Sir Tony Brenton, thank you very much for your time.
It's a pleasure.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, the final search for missing Malaysian flight MH370 has started, with investigators saying that the search will be wound down for good in January if no sign of the missing plane is found. But for relatives, the pain will still go on. And we have the Labour Party MPs who made a lovely Christmas song, or not, depending. You can be the judge, because we'll play you a clip of it at the end of the programme. But first, the UK government's top lawyer is in the US on a campaign to bring more Daesh terrorists to justice, following the announcement that Britain has so far successfully prosecuted 71 offenders for terrorist-related acts. Sputnik's Juliet Spare has been following this story, and she joins me on the line now from London. Juliet, what's this visit all about?
Well, Jeremy Wright QC is in New York to support a campaign, he says, to bring Daesh terrorists to justice. So far, the UK has prosecuted 71 offenders relating to the conflicts in Syria and Iraq, and this number is expected to rise. So that's what he's in New York, really, to tell the delegates of this conference.
Hmm. And what will the Attorney General say then?
It seems to be a little bit of a post-Brexit charm offensive, with the Attorney General set to meet with UN officials to promote his role in prosecuting Daesh terrorists and reiterate the importance of gathering global intelligence. What he'll actually say is that terrorism is a global threat that requires a coordinated international approach, and that the international community has united to defeat these organisations before, and we've already seen many successful prosecutions here in the UK. So like I say, it seems a bit of a post-Brexit charm offensive.
And why would the Attorney General be so keen to spread this message over the pond?
Well, during the United Kingdom's campaign to remain in the European Union, the former Prime Minister David Cameron claimed that the leader of the Islamic State would be pretty happy if Britain left the European Union. He told delegates at the World Economic Forum in May 2016, in his words, that I suspect al-Baghdadi would be happy if the UK left the EU. So it seems that while the current British administration is carrying out their negotiations with Europe and its wranglings over the future severance with the EU, the government's top lawyer, meanwhile, is in New York trying to secure intelligence relations and reassure delegates there that the UK's legal services are very much open for business post-Brexit. So while the UK's top government lawyer tells the US how important and effective and robust Britain's legal system is, the same government is waiting on a decision by the Supreme Court over a High Court ruling that Article 50, the way in which the UK leaves the European Union, needs parliamentary approval first. So it seems that Brexit is receiving a dose of the UK's own robust justice system that the Attorney General is telling the US all about.
Well, Juliet Spear, thank you. In an age of interconnectivity and electronic monitoring, you might think it would be impossible for a modern airliner packed with over 200 passengers to completely disappear without trace. But in 2014, that's exactly what happened to flight MH370, a Malaysian airliner en route to China. All indications suggest someone aboard the flight, either one or both of the pilots, switched off electronic location devices before turning the aircraft around and flying towards the South Indian Ocean. Almost 3 years on, and investigators are beginning to give up hope of ever locating the main body of wreckage, let alone identifying what caused the airliner to deviate from its original flight plan. As our reporter Mark Hurst has been finding out, the disaster may prove one of the most enduring aviation mysteries of all time.
Malaysian 370, climb flight level 350.
Climb level 350, Malaysian 370.
Malaysian 370. Malaysian 370, contact Ho Chi Minh 120.9. Good night.
Good night, Malaysia. 370.
the last radio traffic from pilots aboard flight MH370. On the 8th of March 2014, the Malaysian Boeing 777, weighing 270 tonnes and carrying 239 passengers and crew, took off from Kuala Lumpur International Airport en route to Beijing. But less than an hour after takeoff, it mysteriously disappeared over the South China Sea and into the history books. Initially, air accident investigators believed they were dealing with a relatively routine aviation disaster, but radar data released in the days following the disappearance revealed something more sinister had taken place. The transponder, the electronic device that is used by traffic control to track aircraft, had been manually switched off. Subsequent radar tracking from Thailand revealed the aircraft had performed a U-turn over the South China Sea and had travelled west before disappearing from radar screens. Air accident investigators, led by Australia's Joint Agency Coordination Centre, concentrated their search in the southern Indian Ocean. But despite carrying out a multinational recovery search effort covering 6,600,000 square kilometres, investigators still have little to go on. A few fragments confirmed as having come from MH370 have been washed up on remote beaches in the Indian Ocean and East African coast, but the crash site, believed to have been on a long search arc 2,000 kilometres off the west coast of Australia, has still not been located. Last month, investigators announced they were in the final stages of their quest to find out what happened to the Malaysian flight, but said that without credible new information, they would be winding up their search.
In the absence of credible new evidence, Australia, China and Malaysia have collectively decided to suspend the search upon the completion of the 120,000 square kilometre search area. I must emphasise that this does not mean that we have given up on locating MH370. If there are any new credible news or new evidence, we will continue to work together to analyse those evidence.
But as the Dutch survey ship Virgo Equator set out from Fremantle to undertake the final search operation, hopes are diminishing that any substantive trace of the aircraft will ever be found. This last mission will conclude in January or February, but investigators have said they will target an area of 46,000 square miles in one last effort to find the main part of the wreckage and bring some kind of closure for the relatives. The survey vessel will concentrate on previously searched areas, but will examine locations on the seabed that had proved difficult to secure image data. Experts believe the location of debris already washed up indicates they have been searching in the right location, but still MH370's last resting place remains elusive. So despite what Australia Transport Minister Darren Chester described as a heroic undertaking, the mystery of what happened to flight MH370 is likely to remain unknown, and the pain of relatives will continue.
And finally, well, it wouldn't be Christmas without these strains of Madure and Bono singing about the fact that it never snows in Africa. And, well, ever since the original Band-Aid Christmas song, Do They Know It's Christmas, came out in 1984, there's been attempts to recreate that magic, or for a lot of people, get the tune stuck in their heads all over again. But now the famous Christmas song has been reworked by a group of UK Labour Party members of Parliament who've rewritten the words to raise awareness of degraded workers' rights in the United Kingdom. Siobhan McDonagh led the group of MPs, which included Dan Jarvis, Mary Cray and Shadow Education Secretary Angela Rayner, who sang not about Africa but Scrooge Bosses in Britain in 2016. It should be said that the video doesn't feature any actual musicians or singers, and it doesn't use any technology such as, say, auto-tune. But you can be the judge of whether or not that shows, because we'll be playing you out with a clip from the recording in just a minute from now. If you'd like to watch the video in its entirety, you can head over to our Twitter account, which is _WorldInFocus. And of course, you should obviously follow us for all the latest information about World in Focus. Until tomorrow, though, this is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh, and in just a moment we'll go over to Washington, D.C. for the Tom Hartman Show. Till tomorrow, from me, Jack Foster, goodbye.
Christmas is hard on the national minimum wage.
At Christmas time, we give what some employers take. And we know that they have plenty, but they give out less and less. Stand up against them.